Welcome to your Right to Speak discussions on social justice and advocacy. This is episode 21, and I'm your host, Salvatore. Jen is on the phone with us. I hope everyone can hear her. We've missed Jen on a couple of episodes, so I'm happy to have her back here. I kind of missed her as having her as my co-host. So welcome back.
Thank you.
On today's episode, we'll be starting a new series on the topic of mental health, and we'll be talking with Catherine, who is not only a colleague and a friend, but also an old professor, my old program coordinator when I did my undergrad in child and youth care at Humber. So I'm very honored to be able to be talking with Catherine and having her on the show today. Catherine, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. Thanks so much to Sammy and Jen for having me. My name is Catherine Sloss, and I am a professor and program coordinator here in the Bachelor of Child and Youth Care here at Humber College. In my other sphere of life, I'm also a child and youth counselor at St. Joseph's Health Center on the inpatient child and adolescent mental health unit. And I've been working there for, over 16 years now. So my passion and my roots are really based in child and adolescent mental health. So I'm really excited to be chatting with you folks today.
Well, thank you again for speaking with us today. I guess we're just going to dive right into it. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'll go for the first question. Mm-hmm. So what are some of the differences between services for youth with mental health challenges and adult services for mental health?
For sure. I think there's much more that we are learning in terms of research about the young brain. So quite often we need more intensive services happening at younger ages to prevent young people from being sort of experiencing more severe mental health issues in their adult lives. So that research is always ongoing. So we're finding out more and more every day about how we can prevent, or, you know, if things are already in motion, how we can intervene and, you know, implement intervention strategies to support young people for better outcomes. So the services that you really need for youth can be quite intensive because you really need to address them holistically. You need to look at all the aspects that are happening around them and to support them in all those areas. So that can take a lot of money and time and resources. So often that can be quite challenging. Whereas adult is a little bit different. People have reached an age of consent. People have much more lived experience. So the resources that they might need might be quite different. Some of the symptoms or some of the challenges you might be tackling might be quite different than a young person who's living with a family, trying to go to school, trying to progress through their lives. So there are definitely differences in the severity or the resources that are required in those services, for sure.
So it sounds like with the youth services, it's more looking, more including other elements or considering other elements of their life.
For sure. That's super important. So in the work we do at our hospital, we involve the school. We involve the might be family, extended family, elders, community mentors, spiritual people, whoever is connected to the young people are important in that treatment planning process. That's something that we really want to do. So we, you know, in terms of the services, that requires a lot of work and time and energy to bring all of those folks together. And we really want to hope for better outcomes for young people. So absolutely.
So I just want to, because we all know that I used to work at the Advocate's Office.
Yes.
So in a recent report that the office had just published, we have something to say, which is about children and youth with special needs as well as mental health.
Absolutely.
One of the, I guess, gaps that had come out with services was transition services going from adult to youth.
Yes.
Have you noticed this?
Yes, it's a huge issue. Because what happens is as young people approach the age of 18, they may have received very intensive support services, say on a child and adolescent unit, which might have at max maybe eight young people on that unit. There's a high level of supervision, a high level of intervention and intervention happening. As they start to age out or get to closer to that age when they're going to have to go to adult services, some of those units have 40 people on a unit. So you're getting a very different level of supervision. You're getting a different level of intervention. And also the types of professionals that you're working with, right? So on our units in child and adolescent, we have a social worker, child and youth care practitioners, we have nurses, psychiatrists, and so on. So a teacher from there. Those resources may look different in adult and how often people are experiencing those resources. When you have 40 people for one social mm-hmm. worker or a couple social workers, it can be sort of limited. And, you know, people have talked about sort of feeling more alone and not necessarily connected in the same way. So that can be a real tricky part. And we know that, you know, the development of schizophrenia and other major mental illnesses are happening between the ages of like 16 and 24.
Right.
And so in those transitional ages, when you're between services, you know, too old for young inpatient and too young to really be appropriate for an adult unit, when you can really be a victim of whatever on that type of a unit, it can be very, very precarious for young people. And really their vulnerabilities are really a problem at that time.
Yeah, like that's what I was thinking
yeah.
was that, you know, there's a part where, you know, trust and, you know, relationship mm-hmm. is built with all the workers.
Absolutely.
And then when you transition, you know, I can see, you know, all the vulnerabilities,
yes.
you know, being built up again.
For
and,
sure.
you know, the trust issues, you know,
mm-hmm.
being, you know, opened up again. And,
absolutely.
You know, it would be very hard to kind of deal with that.
For sure. And the types of professionals, again, we have very wonderful nurses in our institutions. But the other thing is that nurses are then being responsible for the medical care
mm-hmm.
as well, because there may be medical things going on with the adults, but also now the psychosocial support. Whereas on our unit, there are child and youth care practitioners and nurses. So if some team member isn't necessarily comfortable or doesn't have the counseling skills or whatever it might be, or group facilitation,
mm-hmm.
as CYCs, we're critical in those spaces,
mm-hmm.
right? Whereas other units may have a mental health worker with a certain type of background, like we don't know, right? So
right.
In terms of getting those varied types of supports, that might not be happening in the same way it does in a child and adolescent setting.
And I can imagine mm-hmm. it being like a very scary feeling.
It can be very scary. Like as someone who, you know, you can, you know, who has extensive experience, but going to a unit with many people and sort of very big spaces where you can't see everything
right.
all the time, it can be really scary for people. Really, really concerning.
So what do you think could
mm-hmm.
be a solution to kind of address mm-hmm. this gap?
For sure. I think that having some transitional supports, and some community agencies have had like transitional housing
mm-hmm.
for this age group, like, and really we need to consider that adolescence is really going to age 24 now, right?
Mm-hmm.
What we know about the brain is that things are still developing. People don't wake up on their 18th birthday and become an adult, right?
Right.
That's not, or some, you know, some kind of more, you know, sophisticated young person or whatever. The fact is that the brain is still developing. So we need to be able to offer these supports specifically during these times. It's critical. So I think really placing resources and funding into that transitional support. All areas of mental health support need money and need resources without a doubt. But because this is a major gap that's been identified, I think it really needs to address these young people in these ages. Like, so there needs to be specific programs to support
mm-hmm.
and to really prepare so that when you're, you know, in your early 20s and you are going to be heading into that adult system, because we know that mental health issues can be chronic
mm-hmm.
and we know there are ups and downs and ebbs and flows in these types of diagnoses. So the reality is that the person needs to be involved with the system over time, and that's fine, but getting them ready and having people specifically supporting them to get informed, because people don't get a tour of an adult unit or an adult service, they just end up there.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas like, what if we could take the time in those transitional years to support people to get connected so that they wouldn't be on wait lists forever, you know, they would be able to get into those services in a timely way. So it's tricky, but it really is an area that needs a lot of focus.
Well, mm-hmm. thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to forget that. Yeah. No, I was going to say, we don't want to forget you, Jen, so I was going to ask.
Yeah. Actually, it was, you just mentioned waitlist, and I had a question about that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
When a youth or a teenager and whatnot end up on a wait list instead of getting services?
Yeah.
Well, is there like a short-term service? And if there isn't, how would you say that impacts their mental health?
For sure. Every region, every area is different. And a lot of agencies and systems have basically tried to come up with their own solutions. So we know in Toronto there have been a number of walk-in counseling services that have been put up by Oolagan, which has a new name. I forget what the name is now. But a lot of sort of community agencies have started to have these more emergent services that people can access on a sort of a quick basis, which is great. But also when people are on a waiting list, you know, things can get worse, right? So you can have someone go into crisis, and then instead of being on a waiting list, they're now in the emergency room of a hospital, right? So we need to sort of be aware that those things also happen. And then so although they were on a wait list, the situation has worsened and the person is decompensated. And so now they're, you know, getting a different type of support. So it is really different across each sector, like community mental health versus like, you know, hospital versus, you know, walk-in services or drop-in counseling. And of course, then it forces people as well, like, you know, do people have the money for private support? And then families are faced with the pressure of like, can I pay a psychologist or can I pay a counselor instead of waiting? And that's a really hard decision for people that may be struggling with financial issues already.
Yeah, definitely. Is there, so for say someone who like doesn't have the money to put their child, or like if a teenager or young adult doesn't have the money and they're kind of stuck on a waiting list, do you have any like advice for them? Like, I know they can't get services, but is there anything they can do to kind of help their situation?
For sure. And I think it puts a lot of onus on the family to advocate. So it puts a lot of pressure to get existing things. Like there might be, so, you know, you say you have a young person who's on the waiting list for a day treatment program, right? But, you know, to put pressure on the agency to say, you know, can we get some respite? Is there any funding for this? Can we get, you know, someone to, you know, it could be a new grad, could be someone who's working in an agency like Bartimaeus. Can we get a couple of hours after school for some support, some relief for the family? So a lot of the times they try to do those stop gaps. You know, for example, in hospital, we have an outpatient classroom. And so that we never really had that before. That was just something when kids left the hospital, we said, come back to the classroom. So we actually had no extra staffing, no extra funding, no extra teacher. But we did it because we knew if the kids left the hospital and they didn't have something to do during the day, they'd probably decompensate. So a lot of sectors sort of fill those gaps without actually having any resources allocated to them. So that's what we need to push back on and get those pieces. And so we've been able to be successful and get a teacher and have an extra classroom, but that took a long time to be able to do.
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, it may not be the exact service that you're getting, like while you're on the wait list, but, you know, there are alternatives. Can there be some funding for programming for that young person to get a one-to-one worker for a few hours a day to give some relief to the family to support them as they wait? So it can be tricky, but it's one of those things that, you know, families are sort of forced to advocate for those things. So we as CYCs working with families to be able to try and access any and all pockets of money, resources, and supports, right? It's tricky.
Yeah, makes sense. And when you get the services like that they were asking for.
Sure.
Do you think those services that they get are of a like long enough duration to do anything?
Yeah, I think it depends on the agency. I mean, my experience in hospital is that we keep the young people as long as they need to be there, and we always tell them we don't want to keep you forever. We want to we want you to get moving. But one of the things is that people come to hospital when something in their life isn't working. And there's a serious concern, right? That's why we do it. So I think for my experiences, definitely we attend to the individual, but I know that depending on mandates and money and budgets and resources that many, many spaces, you know, will have like, okay, you can come for 6 weeks and then you're done. And that's maybe not the most efficient way. It's definitely not individualized care, but those agencies are doing the best they can within the constraints that they have. So I think if care was designed to individually meet the young person's needs and was really coming from them, then that would you know, be a better solution and a better focus on that.
Makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to move a little bit towards, I guess, some of like relational type of work.
Yeah.
Often me and Jen have found that CYCs and social workers, mm-hmm. et cetera.
Yeah, practitioners all kinds. Yeah, for sure.
Come into relationship, you know, with the youth who has like mental health challenges, mm-hmm. with their own like stigmas
for sure.
and perceptions of
Absolutely.
That youth or that, mm-hmm. you know, community, and
yeah.
kind of puts the youth in a negative light.
Sure.
So how do you think, or what advice could you give, let's say, new workers, mm-hmm. On how to better work with the youth?
Mm-hmm, for sure. I think one of the things that's critical in this question is that, folks that are coming into this field, if they're being trained by people that have some of these attitudes, they need to find ways to challenge them, right? So if I'm a new, I'm about to graduate and I'm in my final placement and my supervisor says, well, you know, those folks are always looking for this, or they're always looking for a handout, or, you know, this person's being this way because of, right? And there are sort of those biases and stereotypes, and really, based in racism and oppression. So it's my job as a new coming up into this field to challenge those ideas mm-hmm. in my own way. So the minute that you start talking like someone who is training you in that way, you've now lost the youth, right? So you need to challenge those ideas. And it may not be, you know what, supervisor who's evaluating me, I really think that this is not okay. It might be through doing research or sharing something that from a class. Like there are a lot of different ways to share knowledge in an accessible way, because if we call people out on things, sometimes it just makes them go underground. So they're mm-hmm. just not going to say those comments in front of you, but they're going to make them in front of everyone else. So sometimes if we call people in and we can talk to them and give them resources and talk about why, you know, respecting people's pronouns is important, or why it's important to, you know, understand more about Indigenous folks here in this country. So having those conversations can do that. So I think in terms of the relational pieces and stigma, people need to be trying to have conversations where we can end these pieces. There's always this debate, like, do you read someone's file before you meet them? This is like sort of a
yes.
classic debate in social services. And one of those things is sometimes you will not have a choice. So when I go on shift in the hospital, I need to get report. I need to hear how that person's day is going, what their mental state is, how they've been doing, how they're interacting with their family. So what I do is I try to get sort of the gist of everything. And I also need to know about risk. Are they a risk for themselves? Have they, you know, what's going on with them? But then I really launch into trying to get to know them, right? Who are they as a person? What do they like? I like their sweater. I tell them that's really neat. And really try to connect. And so that piece is on me as a practitioner. I can believe whatever I want, but as a practitioner, I need to put those biases aside and say, this is a young person in front of me, regardless of who they are, and I need to really, you know, spend the time getting to know them. And that really needs to be the focus. So if you're working in a team where people are burning out and making negative comments and making assumptions about people, it's hard to be the one to stand up and say, well, maybe it's actually about this. But that is our responsibility, because the minute that we just stand by, we're not being a true ally to those young people.
So what about...
Mm-hmm. Sorry.
That's okay.
Go ahead, Jen.
Off what you were saying.
Yeah.
You mentioned burnout, and I know in... I've just heard from, like, some workshops that I've attended and stuff.
Yeah.
When people get burnout, they kind of... some of them, like, from what I've heard...
Yeah.
They'll get angry almost, right?
Yeah.
They kind of treat... They start treating them...
Sure.
Every individual as, like, a mass group of people who kind of like that they're frustrated at, right?
Yeah.
It's like, well, why do you keep doing this? And
why do you keep coming back to the program? Why do you keep getting suicidal?
Exactly.
Absolutely. Yeah.
How, And I know, like, you know, obviously there's the, like, oh, make sure you go and take enough breaks and do that. But I feel like for some people, for someone who's working and, like, they need to work, they can't go on the vacation.
Yeah.
How would they help not get those feelings of burnout and,
for
I guess, like, the negative effects?
Well, the first thing is around self-awareness. It's because you may not even know that you are even heading this way. And sometimes it can be tough, but as good practitioners, sometimes we need to say to our colleagues, I've really noticed that you seem super upset about this, or what's this about? And through that process, someone may get defensive, or they may be, you know, open to hearing that. But hopefully through a process of self-reflection, ideally as practitioners wanting to work with young people, our goal would be to be better practitioners. We should always be aiming for that. So if someone says to us, I'm noticing this, I'm noticing these ideas, I'm noticing your behavior, it really is a wake-up call to us to pay attention. And if we don't pay attention, and if we just put our head down and keep plugging away, something bad will end up happening at some point, I'm sure, because we're not paying attention to the signs of burnout. And we know that there's burnout, but we also know there's vicarious trauma, right? That can really negatively impact our work, and it really creates a space where there can be no connection to young people, and really your own health and mental health become at risk. So that's something that we want to avoid. So it is important to stay fresh with things. It's important to have good team discussions, open discussions, and also to practice feedback. How do you get feedback? How do you respond to feedback? And it sounds simple, but a lot of people think, like, if someone gives them feedback, they need to be defensive, or it's saying that they're not doing a good job. Well, that's not what we're saying at all. This is about the young people in our care and doing the best things we can in practice to support them. So if you have someone that continues to resist, that becomes a performance issue in that agency, I think. And then the management really have to find ways to support them individually and to help them get some extra training or support to figure out what's happening. Because then if youth are being negatively impacted, that's a problem.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. And so I guess basically what I'm trying to ask is, how would you also separate the mental illness from the individual?
For sure. The thing is that we do this all the time, right? Like, we don't go around saying, hi, I'm Catherine, I'm heart disease. Hi, I'm Catherine, I'm diabetic. I'm this, I'm that. I'm stage 4 cancer. We don't identify with physical diseases and conditions in the same way. So why is it that we feel that we can say that person's autistic, that person's schizophrenic, that person, that's not the person, that's one aspect of them. So I think that it's not really for me about separating it. It's about realizing that this is something that's happening for the person, identifying it as part of the condition that they're experiencing, and also allying with them to say, we want to help you address this. We want to help you because something in your life isn't working and it looks like it's this. So let's work together on this. So I don't think that depression has to be separated, but I think you can externalize it. You can say, you know, depression affects so many people. No wonder, you know, that this has happened to you, and that's okay because we can help you work with it. And here's some of the treatments, and here's some of the things that we can practice, and here's mindfulness, and we can do yoga, and, you know, this will help you with your anxiety. We can find ways to normalize it. And to let people know, you know, that this is okay and we can support them. You know, there's a stat that says 1 in 5 people in Ontario are affected by mental illness. Well, that's completely untrue. It's 5 in 5, right? Because if my neighbor has a mental health issue, that's going to affect me. That's going to affect, you know, their community. That's going to affect their church. Everybody is impacted. Everybody is impacted. We cannot really be away from this. So it's really important for us to normalize it. And to let the young people know that we can help with this. They've done nothing wrong. It's not their fault that they have bipolar disorder. Nobody did anything. Just like we would never assume that it's someone's fault that they have diabetes or cardiac or cancer. We would never assume that. So, and we would never tell people, oh, get over your cancer, get over your diabetes, get out of bed, you're so lazy. But these people with mental health issues hear these negative stigmatizing comments all the time. So we really, really need to be clear about that, and the fact that, you know, this is something that people don't choose, But it's something that they have and they're working through, and how can we ally with them to support them for, you know, the best outcome.
So we're almost done.
Perfect.
We have to squeeze in these last two questions
because awesome.
These two are very important.
Okay.
So what me and Jen wanted to ask mm-hmm. you with someone with your experience and mm-hmm. working within the mental health
yeah.
community, what is the one piece of advice
for sure.
you could give
for sure
to someone?
For sure.
And what is the one thing you've learned?
For sure. One of the things that I think through the experience of working in child and adolescent mental health, it can be very easy to get sucked into the burnout. It can get very easy to get sucked into that daily grind because it's hard work.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard work. And if you continue to see it as hard work, you forget the benefits of it and the privilege that you have of working with these young people that teach us so many things about ourselves and about, you know, working with how to work with them and how to support them. So I think in terms of one thing I've learned is to always go beyond the diagnosis. You might hear this person has a million diagnoses and all these things are going on, but who is that person? That person mm-hmm. is someone's child. That person is someone's partner. That person is someone to a lot of people. So really, really getting down to that level of who is this person beyond all of the medical diagnoses that have been placed upon them, upon, not letting that define them. And I think in terms of a piece of advice I can give, I think it's very important to pay attention to the signs of burnout. I've experienced going towards burnout once in my life. And because I was able to identify it, I made major changes. I did a job share. I started teaching. And I've never felt burnt out in my life again because I get, you know, excited about opportunities. I try and engage myself in, you know, intellectually, but also in practice. So every time when I do a shift at the hospital, I think to myself, I'm so grateful. Like, even if it was hard and even if there was like, who knows, kind of stuff went on, I'm grateful because I get to experience that and I get to be taught by these young people about what mental illness is, what are the impacts, and then how can I as a practitioner be helpful. But we can never underestimate the power of connecting with people. You know, do you want a warm glass of milk at bedtime because you're locked in a hospital and like things are hard? Like little things we can do because people are human, and reaching out, like, how are you doing today? What can we do? How can we help? Little things that we can do in these different environments to support people are super critical. So I think that's important. For sure.
Well, thank you. Now, mm-hmm. one last question,
yeah.
and we all know that the listeners
sure.
know this is coming. I feel like I say that every episode. It's something that me and Jenna found means something different mm-hmm. to everyone.
Okay.
So we wanted to ask you, mm-hmm. what does advocacy mean to you?
For sure. I think when you're working with child and adolescent populations, advocacy is finding ways that you can use your own privilege and power to open doors to get these young people resources and support. So you may be working with a family that is struggling significantly on a number of levels. It's up to us to advocate for the appropriate supports. As advocates, we also need to know when to step back. And mm-hmm. that would also be something that we think about in terms of allyship. And to allow the families to dictate and the young people to dictate what they need in their care. We may have some really great ideas and we may be able to support them with it, but they may also have things that they say, we need this. We need spiritual ceremony in this person's treatment. We need exposure to elders. We need exposure to all these different types of things before we're ready to look at antidepressant medication. And so as practitioners, we need to be open to that. We need to advocate for the best opportunities for our young people and their families, but we also need to be able to know our position and really kind of be aware of it. Because being an ally, we know it's a verb, not a noun. So it's active, but we also, part of that is knowing when to listen and when to hear, and also to know our role and not to step over or talk over, and really to listen to the young people. So that's what it means to me.
Well, I like that very much. I think it's
Thank
a good
you.
Way to end. I know that me and Jen
yeah.
both have learned a lot from you,
Thank you.
That five and five,
yes.
you know, thing that you've
yes.
said was very refreshing, actually.
For sure.
So it was
yeah.
kind of a light bulb moment. Mm-hmm. So thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else you would like to say, Catherine, before we end the conversation?
For sure. I just hope that, you know, everyone that's coming into the field of child and adolescent mental health just continues to remember that these are young people that mm-hmm. need our support. It can get really easy to just see them as a diagnosis or a case file or whatever it might be, but these are young people with real needs. And so we do, as child and youth care practitioners, as social workers, as all these helping professions, we have a privilege and we have an opportunity to support them to have better life outcomes. And I hope that people really see it that way, as opposed to something, you know, just a job, because it's mm-hmm. much more than that, right? We have so many benefits to doing this kind of work. So I'm very grateful to be able to continue to do it.
Well, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Your right to speak will be posted on the second Wednesday of every month. Thank you again, Catherine, for taking the time out to speak with us today. It was nice
My
seeing
pleasure.
You again.
Absolutely. Always nice to see you, Sammy. And then nice to meet you too, Jen.
Yeah, it's good meeting you too. Thank you.
If you are a child or youth that would like to be on the show, or if you have an idea of what topic we should be talking about, you can email me or Jen at yourrighttospeak@gmail.com. That's yourrighttospeak@gmail.com. Let's raise awareness together.
This concludes this month's episode of CYC Podcast. Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher. Visit us on our website at cycpodcast.org. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/cycpodcast.